Good morning again, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which we are sitting at the Olmsted County Government Center in Rochester, hearing four oral arguments. We are now ready for oral argument in the third case. The third case is number A23-1664, State of Minnesota versus Andre Leon Franklin. I'm sure counsel are familiar with our procedures and protocols. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Russett. I represent appellant Andre Franklin. A jury found Mr. Franklin guilty of promoting the prostitution of an individual and soliciting an individual to engage in prostitution. The sole issue on appeal is whether or not the district court erred by allowing the state to introduce admissions that Franklin made after the alleged offense, admitting that he had prostituted other women. The state claims that these admissions were properly admitted as immediate episode evidence. But the Supreme Court has made clear that this court must review the rationale that the district court judge gave for admitting the evidence. The district court in this case did not admit this evidence as immediate episode evidence. It specifically rejected the state's argument that it was immediate episode evidence. The court instead admitted the evidence as other act evidence under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 404B. This court's analysis, therefore, must review the district court's decision to admit it as 404B evidence. The district court abused its discretion here by admitting it under Rule 404B for a number of reasons, primarily because the prerequisites for admitting evidence under 404B simply were not met in this case. Other act evidence, other crime evidence, is not admissible under 404B unless the state gives written notice prior to the omnibus hearing, identifying the specific facts it intends to introduce, and identifying the purposes for which it is seeking to admit this other crime evidence. The state here did not provide written notice until basically a year after the omnibus hearing was held.
But didn't defense counsel concede? I mean, the first time when the state was just trying to have it admitted as an immediate episode, that there was no prejudice then. So why?
Well, I think I agree, Your Honor. The defense did concede that there was no prejudice to the defense, but I think it's important to remember that the notice requirement serves a couple of purposes. Certainly, one of them is to give the defense notice so they can prepare. Right. The other is to give the trial judge notice and opportunity so that the judge can properly evaluate the admissibility of the evidence. The state, in addition to explaining what the evidence is, has to identify the purposes. This puts the judge on notice so that he can evaluate the evidence and determine whether it is admissible for the purposes. If you look at the record in this case, you'll see that the judge had a real hard time figuring out what the purposes that the state was seeking to admit this evidence.
Right? I mean, defense counsel submitted a motion in limine, and I'm talking about the second time around now, and the state submitted a memorandum. So the court had that. I mean, a written memoranda, and then the state out loud kind of at the... It was right before a trial, discussed the reasons, the court, you know, reevaluated.
It did reevaluate its initial decision, but the court didn't know when the state first argued the 404B argument at the first hearing what the purposes was. And even at the second hearing, there was a lot of back and forth between the judge and the prosecution about what is the purpose. And I want to make clear, if this was the only...
You can move along.
But I think it has to be taken into account when we're looking at the big picture here. The second requirement of 404B basically is that the court cannot admit the evidence unless it finds that the state has proven the prior crimes or prior acts with clear and convincing evidence. The district court in this case never made such a finding. It, in fact, at the initial hearing on this issue, specifically found that the state had not met its burden of proving these prior acts by clear and convincing evidence. When it reconsidered the ruling to admit it later, it didn't make a contrary finding. It didn't address its prior finding.
But did the court implicitly do that when it said, well, I don't think there needs to be any corroboration because it you know, for whatever reason, it's an admission, whatever. And in the defense memorandum, the second motion in limine submitted, the argument, it wasn't raised again that it's not clear and convincing evidence. So what do we do with that?
Well, I think the rule requires and specifically says the court shall not admit evidence unless it finds the state has proven the prior act with clear and convincing evidence. And when you have a finding by the court when this issue first came up that the state did not meet its burden, I think that's controlling unless until the district court says, I've reconsidered that ruling and find now specifically that it was met with the clear and convincing evidence.
Why can't we say, well, that's what the court implicitly ruled when it said there's no need for corroboration here? This is enough.
Well, it didn't say this is enough. It questioned whether corroboration was required. And there was a discussion with defense counsel about that.
Right.
Let's go to the next step here because on the clear and convincing, let's assume that the court did find.
Yep.
I would suggest to this court that ruling would be clearly erroneous. The question that before the district court was not whether the state proved that Mr. Franklin made the statements.
Right.
I would suggest that they did prove that he made the statements. They're recorded. The question is, did they prove the prior acts, the prior crimes? They presented no evidence in this case that he actually prostituted other women. They proved that he said he did, but they didn't present any evidence of the prior
acts.
What
about the text message? Something about, see what I'm running tonight in the photographs on his cell phone.
They may have proved that he admitted to engaging in other acts of prostitution. What they need to prove is the specific acts that he engaged in. And the reason they have to prove that is because this evidence to be admissible has to bear some similarity to the current charge.
Okay, but that's a different question. That's the purpose, as opposed to the level of evidence required for it to be admissible.
I would suggest they're intertwined, because to determine whether the evidence is relevant and bear some similarity, they have to prove with clear and convincing evidence what the prior act was. Not just that he admits he committed an act of prostitution, but what are the facts that underline that prior act and how are they similar to the current charge? Because absent some similarity, they have no relevance and you can't meet the rest of the requirements of the rule. So I don't know that you can review these things in isolation. I think the clear and convincing thing goes all the way through this. If we don't know what that prior act is, how do you determine relevance?
Well, how do we not know what that prior act is? He says, I sell women. This is what I do. And then on his phone, he's got, look at what I'm running tonight, which is this victim. So what is deficient about that?
What's deficient about it?
It's going to, because it seems to me the question is, the issue here was, the defense was, he didn't sell her. She, you know, needed money. He said, well, you can go upstairs. He didn't do that. I mean, right? Wasn't that his defense?
That's correct, Ron.
She wanted money.
And she did it on her own.
Upstairs. Yeah. Right. So that's so the question is really kind of the intent, plan, and so what are we missing here?
What you're missing is any facts to show that the prior or the other acts bear some similarity to this, so that they have relevance to intent, plan, or any of these purposes. Otherwise, we're dealing with propensity evidence.
Yeah,
I sell women. Okay, well, you must have sold this woman.
Right.
That's not allowed. If you sold women under similar circumstances, such that it bears on the disputed issues in this case, then under 404B, it may be admissible, assuming its probative value is not outweighed by its prejudice. Mm-hmm. But if we don't know the facts of the other acts, there is no basis to conclude that it's relevant or not unduly prejudicial. Look at it from the perspective of the jury. So the jury hears the defendant admitting that he sells other women. That's all they hear. What are they to do with that? What can they do with it without knowing the details of those other sales? and how they might bear on the issue in this case.
Well, what did they do, counsel? In this case, they acquitted him of sex trafficking, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But this wasn't admitted just for the purposes of proving the sex trafficking charge. It was admitted to prove all the charges. Mm-hmm. So the question is, was it properly admitted?
And I appreciate that, but there are, you know, you'll go down the line in terms of it analyzing. And if there was error, does it require reversal?
If what you're asking about is harmless error, assuming the evidence was improperly admitted, was it harmless?
Right.
The focus when determining harmless error is on whether this evidence, assuming it was improperly admitted, played a significant role. Is there a reasonable possibility it played a significant role in the jury's decision? What the court should look at in making that determination is how much evidence was introduced. Was it a big part of the state's case? Was it talked about by the state in closing argument? Is it something that the jury is likely to have looked at and considered in determining guilt? I think the answer to that is obvious in this case, and it's obvious for two reasons. Look at the extent that the state went through to get this evidence to the jury. Even after the district court ruled it was not admissible initially, they turn around, they amend the complaint, they ask the court to reconsider, they make additional arguments. We go from immediate episode evidence to intent and knowledge under 404B to identifying every reason under 404B for admissibility. They obviously perceive this evidence as important. Why? Because they know once the jury hears this is what he does, he sells women, we're done. The jury's going to find, well, of course he sold this woman. We have to decide who's telling the truth here.
I guess what I'm looking to you for, counsel, is to help me understand the jury's verdict in total in light of all the record, because the jury actually acquitted this defendant of sex trafficking. So apparently they didn't believe him, or they didn't think the evidence was sufficient. Let's put it that way. I mean, they didn't think the state's evidence was sufficient, maybe for the reason you just said, is that the state didn't prove any specific acts apart from perhaps, and this is the instance with this particular victim.
I think we have to be careful not to read into why the jury acquitted of the trafficking charge. We don't know why. It may be very simply because the trafficking charge was not an appropriate charge in this case, and the state, even with this evidence, failed to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That doesn't mean that the jury didn't consider the evidence in deciding his guilt of the other crimes. And I think at this point, the question the court has to ask is that a reasonable possibility? And when you look at the fact that the state started their case, their first statement to the jury referenced his admission, the state's opening statement. First thing out of their mouth was a quote, "I sell women, that's what I do." And then they presented the issue to the jury as, did he sell this woman? And we're going to prove that he did.
What do we do with the victim's testimony in evaluating whether this error was, again, assuming the error is determined, we agree with you on the error. How do we evaluate the victim's testimony?
I don't think you do. The question here isn't whether or not the jury was justified in crediting the victim. They may have credited the victim and still had doubt about, boy, you know, we kind of believe her, but we're not sure. But you know what? This is what he does. It may be the determining fact in determining who's credible here. So I don't think the fact that we have evidence that would support a verdict sufficiency-wise has any real bearing on whether there's a reasonable possibility the wrongly admitted evidence impacted that decision. In fact, the Supreme Court has repeatedly said this is not a sufficiency of the evidence analysis. And even if the evidence of guilt is otherwise overwhelming, that doesn't mean that the wrongly admitted evidence did not impact the jury's decision. So instead of looking at the victim's testimony, you look at how what role the wrongly admitted evidence played during the trial. Started off an opening statement, elicited this testimony from at least four different police officers during the course of the trial, played at least four different recordings of the statements that were made, talked about it in closing argument. There is no way that the jury in this case missed the importance of this evidence to the state's case. So assuming it was improperly admitted, I don't think the record in this case would allow a determination that it was harmless error.
I have a question that goes back to square one, I think, and that is, given the amended complaint, was this even other acts evidence, or as the text of the rule says, evidence of another crime, wrong, or act? It seems to me that it was evidence of the very thing that was alleged in the amended complaint.
The amendment charged Mr. Franklin with trafficking this individual.
And what about the sex trafficking charge?
Well, that's the amendment.
Pre-trial or on the eve of trial, we had three charges. The district judge had three charges in front of it. And I mean, I feel like, the amendment is clearly why the district judge changed its ruling, right? District court.
I think that's a fair assumption.
But if sex traffic, I mean, I understand, I haven't stared down the elements of sex trafficking, but I think it involves a broader scheme, broader than one person. And am I correct or not?
I don't think you are, Your Honor. It talks about an individual providing, transporting, or harboring an individual with the intent to aid the prostitution of that individual.
Well, even understood that way, if he's making a general statement about what he does, which implies, I think, frequently or repeatedly and so on, it seems to me that goes directly to that is basically what he's being accused of.
If the prior act, again, had bore some similarity to what was going on here, maybe. I'd suggest, but it doesn't matter because the jury acquitted him of that charge. So the focus of the court has to be on what effect that evidence had on the other charges and whether it was properly admitted to assist the jury in those other charges.
I have one more question.
Sure.
The state in their responsive brief, and we'll hear more about that in a minute, emphasizes the immediate episode principle, and they presented that to the district court as well. Why can't we consider that? And I'm thinking of the Gruning case, which you're surely familiar with.
Gruning, it stands for the broad proposition that a respondent can defend a lower court actions on other issues or other arguments that were raised below. More specific to this case is the Rosberg and Fardon decisions, which specifically says when admitting other act evidence or other crime evidence, the reviewing court looks only to the rationale that the district court relied upon.
I mean, I think Rosberg is focusing on the relevance of the Spriegel evidence. You know, it's a narrower question. It's not basically a question of alternative theories of evidentiary admission or exclusion.
Let me make one other point then in response to your question. Even if the court this court can consider it, this is an immediate episode evidence. This is immediate episode evidence is evidence of one act that occurs during the commission of another act, such that the two are so intertwined that you can't prove one without the other. The state is introducing admissions the defendant made after the charged offense was completed. There is, contrary to what the state suggests in this brief, there is no immediate investigation exception. That's not immediate episode. Immediate episode focuses on the offenses, not on admissions that the defendant makes after the offense is committed. Let me just suggest the police come to talk to me about a murder. I tell the police I've killed people before, but I didn't kill this individual.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we all agree that my admission that I killed other people doesn't come in unless there's some other specific purpose that it is admissible. The fact that I admit it during the investigation doesn't make it part of this immediate episode.
What about when he said something to the effect of, look at my phone. There are, people were pinging his phone while he was talking to the officer. And I think he made a statement implying that, this was other ongoing business he had at that time.
That time is hours after this offense that he's charged with was committed. It was during his talking to the police. The question is, those other acts, were they part of the offense? The fact that I'm telling the police, look, I got women calling me right now, 2 hours after I supposedly sold this woman, or hours, more than 2 hours after I sold this other individual for sex, doesn't make it part of that episode. It's the offenses, not the admission during the investigation, that has to be part of the original offense.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I'd like to pick up where Judge Johnson left off about the question of whether this is immediate episode or intrinsic evidence, as I would refer to it. And Judge Johnson, you'd asked about the charge of sex trafficking. On page 603 of the transcript, the jury was instructed that sex trafficking means receiving, recruiting, enticing, harboring, providing, or obtaining by any means an individual to aid in the prostitution of the individual. So I would submit this deals with the logistics of connecting people for these acts of prostitution. We have evidence that on Mr. Franklin's phone was a photograph of AMS, the particular victim here, and a statement something along the lines of, you know, look what I'm running into tonight. The inference from that evidence is that he is promoting her or making arrangements for that. And I think the jury is free to infer that this particular patron, JS, referred to, may or may not be the only patron for whom Mr. Franklin is attempting to, provide for some liaison there. But from the very outset of this case, the state, and frankly, the defense, the word Spriegel never came up. I think it's important to consider the timeline, and I'd like to walk through that briefly, if I may.
What do you mean the word Spriegel never came up?
Well,
I don't.
So the incident happens.
Well, the judge discussed it initially and excluded it under Bowles, right? Yeah.
Well, correct, but I think it's important to consider the timeline of this. You know, the incident happened September 25th, 2021. Mr. Franklin was arrested and charged 2 days later by order of detention on the 27th. The public defender was appointed on October 11th, 2021. It was scheduled for jury trial on May 2nd of 2022 now. The trial was continued to the 24th of October. And 3 days before that, there was a substitution of counsel filed and a Brandon lawyer took over for the public defender, Amanda Lindbergh. And they continued the trial to November 28th of 2022. It wasn't until November 15th of 2022 that Franklin's attorney, Brandon Lawyer, filed this motion in limine. It's Doc 53.
Why does that matter?
Well, it does bear cross-decking over to the Spriegel aspect of notice. It was...
focusing on notice. I think you can move along because I think... Yeah. Defense counsel more or less conceded.
Well, I think we're...
There was no prejudice in, yeah.
Well, there's that. But yeah, I guess yeah. I'm coming back to our primary position that this is admissible as intrinsic evidence. And this case was on the table for a long time.
Well, can before... we... The judge... Defense counsel has argued that... we have to go by what the district court judge decided, which is that it's Spriegel, not intrinsic or immediate episode evidence. And so what's your response to that argument?
I just disagree. As for the cases cited by Judge Johnson, that issues raised below that are immediately related to this incident, this court can consider that as an alternative. But I think when you think about this, this case came before Judge King for the first time on November 28th. That was the first day of trial. And that's when this motion in limine filed by the defense came to light. The prosecutor said, well, we're not offering this as Spriegel. This is the direct evidence.
It actually tried until May or June.
It didn't, then it was continued again.
It was
continued again.
Yeah, yeah.
But on that hearing date on November 28th, that's the first time this was presented then to the district court from the Defense motion in limine filed on November 15th. It was Franklin who wants to characterize this as Spriegel evidence. And the prosecutor said, this isn't Spriegel. This is part of our case. We referred to it in the complaint.
Do you contend that if we decide it's not intrinsic evidence, that we should decide whether it's Spriegel? I mean, are you saying it's not Spriegel, so we shouldn't contend?
Well, I've argued that alternatively in my brief, our primary argument. That
and are you sticking with that argument?
I'm consistent with my brief that says, one, it's intrinsic and we need not conduct the analysis. But if we do, as I've argued in our brief, then it's still admissible under a Spriegel analysis.
Okay.
I guess I'm hoping to urge the court to consider and focus on the primary.
This case could be tried, or why could this case not be tried without that evidence? I mean, I think that's the defense's argument about immediate episode. Is that you're talking about two different things. One is prostituting or trafficking this individual, this victim, versus other women. So what? Mm-hmm. So help us out there.
Well, counsel gave a hypothetical example that said he's a defendant. They're asking about him. Marie says, well, you know, I've killed people in the past, but I didn't kill this man.
Right. And
that's different than our facts. That's different than our facts. He says, I'm doing it right now. Look at my phone. I'm getting calls from prostitutes or patrons. This is what I do. I'm doing it now. And it's in the context of an immediate investigation going on about this.
But it's after the fact of the offense with this victim.
Well, minutes, maybe hours, hours of it. I'd say that's intrinsic to this offense.
So
it's an admission.
I'm going to move along to the Spriegel.
Okay.
I mean, unless you
want to. Can I have a question about, it's a question solely about the law. Am I correct in thinking that the immediate episode doctrine is an exception to Rule 404B? In other words, if 404B applies as an initial matter, or if it appears to apply because of another crime, wrong, or act, then the immediate episode will say that's too close to the episode at issue. Or is it, in other words, does the immediate episode doctrine operate on its own even without reference to Rule 404B? That's a question on my mind, and so I'm wondering if you can help me with that.
I don't think of it as an exception. The rule, 404B, precludes evidence of another act that's extrinsic to the case. And I've cited State v. Smith on page 15 in my brief for that principle. It deals with evidence that's part of the case. And this court in Hollins made that definition that in a criminal prosecution, evidence of another crime is intrinsic to the charged crime and therefore admissible without regard to Minnesota Rule of Evidence 404, without regard, it's separate and apart. If the other crime arose out of the same transaction or series of transactions as the charged crime, and either the other crime is relevant to an element of the charged crime, or excluding evidence of the other crime would present an incoherent or incomplete story of the charged crime. How would the state get to present this case without... This is their interaction with him at the time of the offense. He wasn't being interrogated either. This is Mr. Franklin's voluntary statements. They embrace the core of the elements with which he is charged of arranging sex with other women. I think the case law examples cited in the brief are good examples, two of which are prosecution cases. One was where the defendant had physically abused two women who had worked as prostitutes. That's a State versus Washington Davis. And, this court allowed that testimony in. It wasn't immediately related to that particular acts or conspiracy. Well, I don't want to get too far to the facts, but this court found that the testimony of those victims showed that he used threats and violence against these women in order to coerce their continued participation in the prostitution scheme. I don't see that as any farther away from a defendant who makes these admissions. I get the sense here that the defendant just didn't think maybe the Rochester police enforced these things. He said he was from Chicago. Maybe he felt that, I can just talk about this in front of the police. He wasn't a suspect. He called the police himself to have AMS ejected from his apartment, and he's just waiting outside freely discussing this. In fact, he even solicits the officer itself, asking if he was interested in any particular women. How does the state, isn't it tying the hands of the state to not allow them to present the evidence from this investigation and the voluntary statements of the defendant relating to the very acts with which he's charged?
I think I diverted you from answering Judge Siegel's question about your Spriegel argument, and so I should.
Well, and I've addressed that in our brief. It's again our secondary argument, but I think the notice argument is misplaced. It was the defendant who characterized this as Spriegel evidence in the first place. On the day of trial, it came up shortly before trial. Judge King looked at it, you know, understandably erred on the side of, maybe I don't say understandably, but said, well, I'm not going to allow it. The very next day, the case was continued, so it really didn't come to bear. The complaint was amended, and here we are with this. But as to the Spriegel analysis, I mean, there's no dispute that he made these statements. So there's clear and convincing evidence he did that. Now, is he engaged in prostitution? In other words, is he telling the truth? You know, I note in our brief that an admission of a defendant is one of the strongest forms of proof known to the law. I mean, how much stronger proof can one ask for than a confession or an admission? And it's not out of context. It's in the context of a woman in the next, just so many feet away in the apartment, telling police in so many words that he sold me. And a patron, JS, who effectively concedes that he had sex with this woman, and perhaps at the suggestion of, or the notion of exchanging it for money with Mr. Franklin. These aren't out of context. It's not just a person walking up to a police officer and say, hey, I sell women for sex. If that were the case, if it was just him walking up to a police officer and confessing, that's a different case. But it's in the context of an actual ongoing prostitution, sex trafficking investigation. So I disagree with the clear and convincing evidence. I think the evidence is strong when we look at the prejudice. We had the direct testimony of AMS, the victim, and the patron. You don't get that every day. And we had both sides of the equation here testifying about the fact that they had sex. There was discussions of money. The only real question of fact was Franklin's part in bringing this about. And, you know, that
so,
was
counsel, that argument confuses me a little bit, because it seems to me that you're arguing that the statement is highly relevant to proving the offense against this victim. So how is it now that we're just going to not consider the, again, assuming the district court erred in admitting the evidence, how would we not consider the impact of that evidence that you just argued was very powerful?
Well, I mean,
and highly relevant. Yeah.
Well, all I'm saying is that if you were to exclude that evidence, I think the state's case is still strong. In other words,
is that the analysis, though? Is that the analysis in a Spriegel case?
Yeah, effectively, is that, did it have the substantial, I mean, maybe stated another way, would the outcome have been, you know, was there a reasonable likelihood?
Reasonable possibility it affected the verdict, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In so many words, that's it. And our position is, even if you would have suppressed all the body cameras and all of his own statements, admissions, you still have the testimony of AMS, the prostitution victim, the patron, JS, his proximity to this. You have to allow some statements in of why are we here and all of that. I, you know, the fact that it's probative evidence, the fact that it's very probative, doesn't make it unfair. Remember, that's the equation we look at here. Is it unfairly prejudicial? In our position, as we've argued in our brief, that it's not unfair to tell the jury what Mr. Franklin himself.
There was a lot of emphasis on the statement in the closing argument.
Well, you emphasize the salient points of one's case when arguing that to the jury. But if it's admissible, that's okay.
Right. But assuming this court follows the line that the appellant reasoned, and it was inadmissible as Spriegel evidence, which was the district court's first ruling in the case, then how do we evaluate the need to reverse? I mean, in light of the closing argument that was given.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, we have direct evidence from two eyewitnesses that the sex act occurred, and it was in the context of an exchange for money. It doesn't get much stronger than that. And
feel free to finish your point or your response to Judge sure. Bradfield's question.
Well, and again, I think if the court looks at this holistically for what it really is in light of the case law, the court can conclude that this evidence is so inextricably intrinsic to this case that a 404B analysis is just unnecessary. But alternatively, even applying the 404B analysis, I think it's admissible, and I'd respectfully ask the court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Haas. Mr. Russert, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Judge Johnson, in response to your question about whether immediate episode evidence is subject to the 404B requirements, I would just note to the court that that issue came up in State v. Ridley before the Supreme Court. They expressly left that question open. So I don't think there's a definitive ruling on whether or not the procedural requirements contained in 404B apply to immediate episode evidence.
Maybe my question, another way to phrase my question is, does the immediate episode doctrine come into play only if the 404B has first been invoked? Or does it immediate episode operate on its own as a freestanding doctrine of either, I'm not sure if it's properly a doctrine of admissibility or a rule of exclusion, but can you help me with that?
Well, I wish I could. I think the general rule, this general starting proposition, is always that evidence of another crime or bad act is inadmissible unless there is some theory of admissibility, such as 404B or immediate episode. So I think we always start with this doesn't come in. We don't try people for what they did or who they are. We try them for based on the evidence of this crime. There are exceptions to the general rule. One of them is 404B. I would suggest that another exception to the general rule would be immediate episode. But again, I can't stress enough, this is not immediate episode evidence. The state is conflating the immediate investigation with the offenses, the immediacy of the offenses.
Wait, except for maybe the sex trafficking charge. I mean, to prove there's sex trafficking going on, it's going on, and this is all part of it. Go ahead and respond.
Well, I think my response simply is we don't need to concern ourselves with that because the jury acquitted him of the sex trafficking charge. We need to focus on whether it was admissible on the other charges that they convicted him of.
Don't we look at that at the time the judge was making the decision, though, not the jury's verdict later?
We do, but the district court, when it admitted the evidence, admitted it on all the charges. So the question is, did the court properly admit it on all the charges, including the two that the jury convicted him of? That's the focus of my argument. They acquitted him of the sex trafficking. Whether it was rightly or wrongly admitted on that charge at this point is irrelevant. What is relevant is, was it properly admitted on the other two charges that the jury convicted him of? Mm-hmm. But again, there is no immediate investigation exception. That's not the same as immediate episode. The state is trying to say that because he made the admission hours after the offense that when talking to the police is part of the immediate episode exception. It's not. We're conflating the investigation with the offenses.
You previously had the hypothetical that if you admit to previously having killed somebody and whether that's but what about let's say we have a drug prosecution and the defendant during an interrogation says, I sell drugs every day. That's how I make a living. In fact, I have these customers and I have X number of customers and every day I make at least 5 to 10 sales of drugs. Because it's so extensive. It's every day. And if there's a charge about an action on a particular day, doesn't the admission encompass the act of the charge?
I would say no. The question, if you're charged with a specific act on a specific day, the fact that you do it all the time or on other days is not, or you know what it is.
Including the day on which the charge was based.
Why? I guess I would pose the question, why would that be relevant? It's relevant because I'm a drug dealer. That's what I do.
It's a damning.
And
admission.
Therefore, I must have done this. That's character evidence. That's a classic example of what's not admissible under 404A. We don't get to be. This is a gen. So I'm a person who does this. Therefore, I must have done this. That is classic character evidence.
Well, maybe not. I have a tendency to do this, but I have done it. In the last month, I have sold drugs every day. Every day of the last month.
If you can prove that on the prior occasion, on every day that I've done this, it's similar to what I did on this day, and it bears on some disputed issue in this case, then maybe. And if you can prove it, all that with clear and convincing evidence, then maybe. But if it's just, I've done this before, I did it today, how does that prove that you did this charged crime without something more, without knowing what you did today and how it is similar to what the state is claiming that you did here? Otherwise, it's just propensity evidence.
So what if a different hypothetical, it's not an admission, it's like a massage parlor, you know, and they want to admit a photograph and it says special services that are likely illegal is on their price board. I mean, that would be other acts, even though they're trying to prove a single act. If you were trying to get that evidence in, that look at what's here, they're in this business. I mean, how is that different?
I think the court has to distinguish between relevancy and whether or not it would bear on his guilt of the instant act and whether it's admissible under the other rules of evidence. Relevancy is a threshold question. It still has to meet the requirements of the other rules, specifically 403 and 408, which says, even though this stuff is relevant, we're not letting you bring it in unless you meet these requirements. Thank you.
So if you have other points, Mr. Russert, feel free to make them. I know that we took a lot of your time.
Oh, that's questions. Fine. The only other thing I wanted to do is caution the court about the extrinsic, intrinsic analogy. I think those cases have been superseded by the Supreme Court's decision in Ridley and Fardon. I think that's the proper analysis. I don't know necessarily that the intrinsic, extrinsic analysis conflicts with that, but I would focus on the analysis of Fardon and Ridley. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Russert. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.